Our next speaker is Mike Hillstrom, University of Wisconsin, and he will be talking about the impacts of global change on hardwood defoliators at the Aspen Face System in northern Wisconsin.
All right, thank you all for being here. I'm going to change directions a little bit here, get away from the pine and the beetles into more community levels, effects, and LEP. And this is all going to be in the context of the Aspen Face site, which has a month left next spring and then is being shut down. So this is going to be a cumulative 11 years of data that I'm going to give you the highlights of here. So I'm going to start off with a little background, CO2 and ozone, and then about the face site, get into a little bit about foliar quality at the site, a few things about individual insect performance, what's going on at the population and community level, and then a little bit about some ecosystem processes. So I'm sure most of you have seen this graph at least once already today. We all know that levels of carbon dioxide have been increasing in the atmosphere exponentially since the start of the Industrial Revolution. What a lot of people aren't aware of is that levels of tropospheric ozone, which is the quote-unquote bad ozone in the layer that we're breathing, have also been increasing exponentially over the same time span. And we know that the ozone layer is a good thing, but like I said, tropospheric ozone is a bad thing. It has detrimental effects on tree health, and it's actually bad for humans as well. So like I mentioned before, I'm going to put all this in the context of our research at the Aspen Face site. It's about an 80-acre site in northern Wisconsin. Have these 12 face rings scattered across the site, and either carbon dioxide or elevated concentrations of tropospheric ozone are fumigated onto the trees through these pipes. And these rings are about 100 feet or 30 meters in diameter. CO2 levels are, well, CO2 and ozone levels are for concentrations that are predicted for about 2060, although that may be a little bit low at this point. So just to kind of put this whole talk in context, I'm going to be looking at how CO2 and ozone affect plants. I'm going to talk a little bit about tissue chemistry, how that then feeds into herbivore consumption, survival, growth, things like that. So kind of the indirect effects on the herbivores, effects on natural enemies a little bit, how that all feeds into the community level effects, and then again how that kind of scales into carbon and nitrogen cycles in these systems. So starting off with the two most important things for insects, nitrogen, which is their most limiting nutrients, and then defensive chemicals. And I'm going to be focusing on aspen trees in this. So nitrogen, as you can see from this figure, levels of nitrogen are slightly decreased at elevated concentrations of CO2, slightly decreased at concentrations of elevated ozone. But this is one of the few times where there's actually an interactive effect where you see a stronger effect at when you have both CO2 and ozone than either individually. Typically at Aspen Face, what you see is that effects of CO2 and ozone tend to be additive. So a lot of times CO2 will affect positively, ozone negatively, and they tend to cancel each other out. But this is one case where that's a little different. The other thing I should mention is that nitrogen has never become limiting in this system. So some of these effects may be kind of minor because of that. So we still haven't seen any limitation in growth, even over the 11 years of this study. Defensive chemicals of these aspen trees, looking at condensed tannins and phenolic glycosides. So these are both from the shikimic acid pathway, phenolics. And just kind of the quick highlight is if you see effects, what you tend to see under elevated CO2 is an increase in these phenolic compounds or no change. Whereas at elevated concentrations of ozone, you tend to see a decrease in these defensive chemicals or no change. So how does this scale up to affect the actual herbivores that are feeding on these aspen trees? Start with consumption. You can see from this that aspen blotch leaf miners, at both elevated CO2 and ozone, we found that they have slightly increased consumption, but not significantly increased consumption. Whereas Forest 10 caterpillars, there's really no significant changes at all, although it does depend on what genotype of aspen you're talking about. So there are 5 genotypes of aspen at this site, and they all vary slightly in their ozone tolerance. That's why they were selected. And you do see some genotype effects, definitely. Growth, not much to highlight here again. All the zeros basically mean that we saw no change in the growth of any of these insects. There are some occasions, but if the nitrogen levels aren't changing much and if the defensive compounds don't change much, you wouldn't really expect to see much of a change. There are cases where we do see changes, but again, pretty minor effects overall. However, we have seen strongly significant changes in host preference. So Forest 10 caterpillars and control rings have a slight preference for birch trees over aspen trees. And this is a different section of these rings where aspen trees and birch trees are interplanted. If you look at rings with elevated CO2, you see that the preference for aspen increases slightly. However, in elevated ozone rings, you actually see a strongly significant increase in the preference for birch over aspen trees. And as I kind of discussed before, CO2 and ozone tend to be kind of an additive effect of those two. Reproduction, again with the aspen blotch leaf miners, you can see that the colonization rates, the number of eggs per leaf, was significantly reduced in both elevated CO2, elevated ozone, and the combination treatment. And some work that me and Dave did 2 summers ago, we found that Polydrusis weevils, that the total number of eggs and the number of eggs they laid per day were significantly reduced at elevated concentrations of CO2. We didn't find any significant effects at ozone. So moving on to natural enemies a little bit. So this fly is the parasitoid of Forest 10 caterpillars. As compared to control rings, not much of a change for elevated CO2. However, at elevated ozone, we found a significant decrease in larval survivorship at elevated ozone. And that's going to be a trend that I'm going to highlight again in a few minutes here. This is some work that Ed Mondor did at the Aspen Face site, looking at these aphids, and they give off these alarm pheromones when predators come around. And what he found was that in control rings, about 40% of these aphids would disperse if they sensed this cornicle droplet. In elevated CO2, if they had the same response, almost none of them would disperse. Whereas at elevated ozone, almost 100% of them would disperse off of the leaf. So very interesting changes in behavior as well. All right, scaling this up to the population and community level. This is some work I started as an undergrad, actually. Ed was a part of this a little bit as well. We set up pan traps in each of these rings in the aspen birch section. And we looked at populations of insects. What we found was that in general, phloem feeding insects, populations tend to decrease at elevated CO2 and increase at elevated ozone, whereas populations of leaf chewing insects, parasitoids, and saprophages tended to increase at elevated CO2 and decrease at elevated ozone. And by far the strongest effect was the negative effect of ozone on parasitoids, where we saw upwards of 50% reduction in populations of parasitoids. Looking at the same data as a community data set. So for those of you who aren't familiar, this is a non-metric multidimensional scaling plot. The only importance is looking how the treatments separate in space. So you can see this group of purple triangles down here are the control rings. And you can see that the ozone rings and the CO2 rings clearly separate in space from these. And if you do the statistics, you can see that both CO2 and ozone, this is data for 2003, that the communities of insects, the overall total community, is different in an elevated CO2 ring or an elevated ozone ring from these control rings. And that was the case in 3 of the 4 years we looked at for both CO2 and ozone. And we basically see the same pattern if you split this up by feeding gelda these insects as well. This is my major project for my PhD research I'm working on, trying to finish up right now. And I don't have any statistics for this yet, but I wanted to just discuss it a little bit. So this is looking at visual surveys of aspen and birch trees, three aspen genotypes and birch trees at the site. And just looking at some preliminary data, you can clearly see that communities, insect communities on aspen are significantly different from the insect communities on birch, as you would predict. Even within a year, for aspen, the June, July, and August communities of insects that are present are very different from each other. Birch, the June community is different, but the July and August communities seem to be relatively similar. If you break that off then to this bottom graph where you look at it by treatment, I don't expect you to see any pattern in this, and I don't see any pattern in this yet at this point, so this is the statistics we're going to be getting into this next for 3 years of data, trying to see how CO2 and ozone work within all of this. And then we're going to take this data and we're going to map nitrogen, carbohydrates, all kinds of tree chemistry variables, as well as weather variables. And we're going to try and see what's driving these changes in community patterns of these herbivores. Lastly, I want to talk just a little bit about ecosystem processes. In this case, canopy damage rates and grass and greenfall deposition. And this is in the context of how CO2 and ozone, how those affect herbivory, how that feeds into nutrient availability in the soil, and how that affects decomposition. This was one of the major goals of our work at Aspen Face, and we're kind of just getting through that data now. So this is 2006 and 2007 data for aspen and birch trees. And what you can see is that damage rates in 2006 on aspen were slightly, moderately significantly higher for aspen trees at elevated CO2, but we saw no changes on birch. However, in 2007, that pattern almost completely changes, and that you see really strong effects, positive effects of CO2, so you have a lot more damage in elevated CO2 plots, and you have significantly less damage in elevated ozone plots on both aspen and birch trees. So how does that affect the frass and greenfall that are coming from the canopy from these herbivores? So these patterns basically mirror the changes in the damage rates, and that in 2006 for aspen, you see a significant increase in the herbivore inputs to the forest floor at elevated CO2, nothing for birch. And then in 2007, again, you see these much stronger effects where at elevated CO2, you have a greater number of herbivore inputs, frass and greenfall, being deposited to the forest floor, and significantly less in ozone. So does this actually have any effect on the soil community? We have some preliminary kind of data that says that it does. So we set up a microcosm study using soil and inputs, herbivore inputs, frass and greenfall that we collected from the face site. What you can see from this is that the amount of respired carbon by microbes, this is a microcosm experiment. You can see that low inputs, so that's what the ALA is on these three treatments, so low inputs of frass, low inputs of greenfall, or low inputs of frass and greenfall have significantly lower respired carbon than high inputs of frass, greenfall, or both. What does this mean for nitrate in the soil? Well, as the amount of respired carbon, which basically implies that the microbial, which we're thinking means the microbial community is expanding, is bigger, what happens is that the amount of nitrate leached from the system actually decreases as the amount of carbon respired increases. So you're getting bigger communities. So as you get more inputs, you're getting larger microbial communities and they're locking up more nitrate. So with that, I'd just like to summarize what I talked about. Effects of CO2 and ozone on plant chemistry are generally modest. They tend to be species and genotype specific, and they tend to be age specific as well. So younger aspen trees tend to have stronger effects from CO2 and ozone than older trees do. The plant-mediated effects of CO2 and ozone on individual insects What we see is that selection and host preferences can be significantly altered, as well as reproduction, but we tend to see modest or no impact on growth or consumption. And I should mention as well that this varies from phase site to phase site, and from greenhouse studies or glasshouse studies to these studies that are in these open air systems. For parasitoids, CO2 and ozone can substantially influence insect defenses against natural enemies and the natural enemy fitness. At the population and community level, we see that different functional groups are differentially affected by CO2 and ozone, and that overall community composition is modified. At the ecosystem level, and we can debate whether a face ring of 100 feet is an ecosystem or not. My committee likes to argue about that. We see that CO2 can markedly increase canopy damage and substrate deposition, but this is not always. It varies from year to year. And ozone has the opposite effect, can decrease canopy damage and substrate deposition. So what does this all mean in the end? Well, it suggests that CO2 and ozone are likely to change the abundance, composition, and impacts of insects in future forests, but the hard part is predictions are not going to be easy because these effects tend to be very species and context specific. And with that, I'd like to end with a hodag for those of you who've never been to northern Wisconsin. This is the mascot of Rhinelander, a scary mythical beast, as you can tell. And I'd like to thank all the people that were involved in this. Like I said, this was an 11-year project. Lots of different graduate students, postdocs, and technicians were involved in this research. So thank you, and I'd love to take any questions you have.
Thanks, Mike. Questions?
Dan?
Yeah, I'd like to, were the ozone levels in these circles, were they high enough to make visible signs or symptoms on the leaves of the aspen trees?
Yeah, I didn't get into that, but yes, the CO2 trees are significantly larger. They have larger leaves, and they're really nice and green. The ozone plots, and at this point in the CO2 rings, it's basically dark underneath the canopy. In the ozone rings, you have these stunted trees with kind of yellowy leaves, and you could get a sunburn really easy in those rings.
Were they high enough to cause the stippling in the aspen leaves where the palisade cells collapse?
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, we see visible ozone damage.
Can you speculate on these patterns or vivary and so forth? How much of that's related to changes in population reproduction within a ring, and how much is related to dispersal in and out of rings from the surrounding environment?
This is, again, much to the debate of my committee. I've got some stable isotope data that I want to get around to, looking at what percentage of these insects are actually living in these rings and what percentage are just flying in and out. There's some potato fields that surround the site, and I do get insects from these potato fields that are definitely just kind of tourists coming in and out of the trees. So it's kind of hard to say at this point. However, things like aphids, we have some species that are definitely, they're not moving out of those rings. There's no way they're moving very far. And we still see differences in population and reproduction of those. So there are definitely some patterns within the rings, but it is a little hard to say what's moving in and out and what's not, and how much of the rings are just recolonized each year. Like to have more time to do that, but.
So these are all natural populations, that is, the insects are not augmented in any way within the rings?
Nope, so this is completely naturally established. Whatever flies in or lives in there on its own is what's there, yep.
These gases are those left out continuously and at an even pace all the time. And I will also expect that with wind and so on, the concentrations will actually vary quite a lot.
The CO2 and ozone concentrations? You take the CO2 and ozone concentrations varying?
Yes.
It's all computer controlled. Mm-hmm. So the rings are actually, there are sensors all the way around. And so based on wind direction, these computers only fumigate from the side of the ring where the wind is blowing from. So they're definitely, we don't do any surveys on the edges of the rings where the concentrations do fluctuate a lot. There's a core area though where the concentrations are relatively stable.
That answered one of my questions, and part of it was answered with insects being stationary there actually. But I see there could be an error introduced if the insects react if they come from an area with one concentration of a gas, and then senses the difference when they come into an area with another concentration.
Absolutely, there's
many animals. We often sense changes more easily than we change the actual conditions if they are stable.
There's definitely a lot of behavioral aspects to this that I just haven't had time to get into. Data sets I'm dealing with are 50,000, 100,000 insects, so there's a lot of time and taxonomy work just built into this that I wish I had more time to do side studies, but just haven't had a chance. Yeah. So yeah, what's predicted for 2060? They're probably actually a little low at this point based on what we think is going to happen. But yeah, ozone concentrations are about 1.5 times. So ozone's a little different. There's a daily concentration profile for ozone. It fluctuates over the course of the day. So again, these computers sense what the ozone concentration is on any given day and spray 1.5 times that, fumigate 1.5 times that into these rings. But more recent papers that have come out, the CO2 and ozone concentrations we're using are definitely, they're almost certainly going to happen. These are not levels that are way out there. One of the interesting points is that a lot of early studies that were done in either glass houses or closed chambers use much higher levels of CO2, and they saw much stronger effects on individual insect performance. When you get out into the real world and use in lower levels at this site, we're seeing weaker effects, and you get into this the aspects of this host switching behavior where they can choose from any number of plants, or they can go to any ring they want to, or they can just fly away and go somewhere else. So as you would expect, when you add ecological complexity, the story gets much hazier and more complicated.
All right, thanks, Mike.